Why is the end of globalization such a huge issue for the average person?
Look at all the things that are troubling us. War, inflation. Those things were absent during the period of globalization. One of the mistakes we make when we debate globalization is we always talk about the wrong countries.
There are four big challenges we face in the next 30 years of our world.
We don't quite know where we're going. We have a lot of debt in the world. We have to get over the hurdle of managing climate damage across the world. The impact of new technologies from small nuclear reactors to AI. Then also the challenge of building institutions and laws and rules and regulations around those.
The idea of democracy lately has been decoupled from progress and quality of life.
Politicians in the West have not done a good job of innovating and renewing democracy.
This is the Innovation Civilization Podcast, and my name is Wahid. Today, we've got Mike Sullivan, who's a managing director at Harvest Innovation Advisory and a senior advisor and a board member at a couple of different companies. He also advises a number of asset management and fintech companies. He's got more than 20 years of experience in the global financial markets, most recently as the chief investment officer at Credit Suisse. He's also the author of the book called The Leveling, which outlines what's next in politics, economics, finance, and geopolitics in the post-globalization era, which we'll be covering. And he recently co-authored another book when it comes to democracy in French language, and also made a documentary about world debt that's ballooning today. He's also a member of the World Economics Forum's Council of New Economy and a Forbes contributor. And he also teaches finance and economics at Oxford University and Princeton University as well. So stay tuned and enjoy the show. All right, brilliant. Mike Sullivan, welcome to the Innovation Civilization Podcast. What a great pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks very much, Wade.
Brilliant. So, Mike, you've got a very eclectic career. Tell us a bit more about who you are and what you do, and especially why you wrote those books in the first place.
Yeah, I guess eclectic is a polite way of saying disorganized or chaotic. There is a logic to what I've done. So I started life teaching as an academic, principally in the area of economics, but I was also interested in adjacent areas like politics, finance, geopolitics. I worked as a lecturer until about 30, and then went to work in the investment industry. So most of my research was in finance economics. I sort of kept an eye on academia and what was happening in the world. And in particular, around the late 90s, early 2000s, in Ireland, the Irish economy, society, and public life changed dramatically. And that change was largely provoked by globalization. With firsthand knowledge, became fascinated by globalization. So wrote a couple of books on that in the Irish context. And then spent much of my life in investment management. I ended up working at Credit Suisse. And one of the things I did a bit on the side was running the Credit Suisse Research Institute, where one of the mandates we had was to sort of focus on new things that were on the horizon. That led me to update and interrogate what was happening with globalization as it was beginning to come to an end. So that's why I wrote the third book, The Leveling.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, really. You mentioned globalization a lot, and then things are changing as well. And then you mentioned some challenges. So can you tell me more about firstly, what you mean by globalization? Is just like globalizing the market, economy, and people and movement of ideas. And is that sort of stopping? Is that what you're trying to say, basically?
Globalization is easier to measure than people think. And it's a word that people bandy around a lot, unfortunately.
Interesting. How do you measure it?
Essentially, it means is a world that is integrated and interdependent. So there's different ways of conceptualizing and measuring it. One very simple way today is to look at all the things that are troubling us, war, inflation. Those things were absent during the period of globalization. Globalization effectively started with the fall of communism and ended with the effective capture of Hong Kong by China in terms of the introduction of the new security laws. So sort of the snuffing out of a pole of trade and democracy. And then specifically to measure it, you can measure it by looking at the flow of trade, not just the level of trade, but actually where it's flowing. Is it flowing from one region to another? The flow of finance, the flow of ideas. Again, the flow of ideas ideas has stopped because parts of the world are shutting themselves off from the free press, from the internet. And then even in countries like America, which is a democracy, it's become so polarized that you just don't get a flow of debate between sort of red and blue tribes or cohorts. Then you look at the flow of people. Migration is a big driver of globalization, and the patterns of migration beginning to change. One more thing to add is that we've had a period of globalization before, from 1870 to about 1910, 1912, when you had many similar trends that we've seen in the last 30, 40 years. And of course, that ended badly, and that should be a lesson to all of us.
Yeah, that's quite interesting, really. And when you say that the flow of ideas is stymied and people are closing themselves off the internet, I'm guessing you're referring to regimes like Russia and China, those folks basically, right? Because internet is quite free in the rest of the world, right? Would you say, in the flow of ideas?
It is free. It's also polluted, I have to say. If you look, for example, at China in the 2000s, Google had about 30% market share in China, and now they've got zero. The flow of communication of ideas is being cut off. And then you've had events that are polarizing the world political debate, Brexit, Trump in the States, that really make it difficult to have either an exchange of views with people, an exchange of information. One of the things I think that is new now is that indisputable information is becoming highly contested. That makes the flow of ideas even tougher.
Yeah. How I always like to think of it is that the information dissemination mechanisms have outpaced the information verification mechanisms when it comes to technology.
Yeah.
So you basically have lots and lots of stuff out there, and many garbage and pollution as well, like you mentioned. But the technologies to verify some of these things as truth is truth, ground truth, that is sort of lagging behind in a lot of ways, which is causing a lot of the chaos and confusion, like you sort of mentioned.
Yeah.
So that's quite interesting. So why is this end of globalization such a big deal? So if I'm like a country, say like China, and I like how you put it, I think you mentioned something like the social contract is China, is that you give a bit of your liberty in exchange for peace and prosperity and I guess stability, right? Why is the end of globalization such a huge issue for the average person? Why should people care?
It should be a massive issue for billions of people, because one of the mistakes we make when we debate globalization is we always talk about the wrong countries. We talk about the UK, the US, maybe Europe. And the UK and the US have not done a good job of harnessing globalization. Globalization has actually seen billions of people in China, India, Bangladesh, Indonesia rise out of poverty. And their lives have been transformed. The cities they live in have been transformed during this period. And by and large, across the globe, it's been a great positive. We should worry that it's coming to an end.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was reading that part you mentioned about like the poverty alleviation in some of these countries and stuff, right? If you look at sort of, say, Bangladesh and India, like you mentioned, if you look at the 18th century GDP figure, 17th, 18th century, actually the Indian subcontinent was like 25% of the world's GDP. This is pre-industrialization, right? Bengal, where Bangladesh is right now, was 12.5% of the world's GDP. Yeah. Obviously, like lots and lots of colonialism happened across a lot of these lands and stuff like that. Again, if you look at the broad brush of history, really, then you see that Asia, the GDP growth and GDP per capita in Asia has always been higher than Europe. It was only the last sort of 400 years or 300 years where there was like a blip. But then, yes, due to globalization, it's sort of increasing again. But if you see the amount of poverty and if you see the lower base that they're starting from, these countries after colonialism, you could argue that it was just a case that they had to get to the mean of what they were pre-18th century. But I was wondering what you sort of make of that.
Yes, the data is actually earlier. So it's actually the 17th century, not the, the 18th century. Around that time, China and India together made up about 50% of world GDP.
Yeah.
There's a very good data series. It's called the Angus Deaton data series. It goes back to the year zero. For most of history, Europe has had the biggest chunk of GDP, and America didn't exist as an economy. China, at times, has been a really big economy. India, in particular, is beginning to thrive today. And India is interesting because it was effectively destroyed by the East India Company, by colonialism. Yep. And that's left so many traces. It's cut India and Pakistan in two. Mm-hmm. So India, it's taken a very, very long some time to recover from that. To tie that into globalization, what is remarkable is that you have so many countries, even if you just look at Asia, from China to India and in between, who are culturally very different in terms of their cultures, their economic structures, but all of them have thrived, have alleviated poverty, have added massive wealth. My judgment is that when that happens across diverse countries, it's not one economic model as such, this phenomenon of globalization. And what is interesting now is that we're beginning to get more diversity in economic performance across countries. You know, China is beginning to slow down. Mm-hmm. India is still picking up. Poland in Europe is looking very, very strong, while the UK is actually very weak.
That's quite interesting, really. And I think in terms of your book, you mentioned that there are four big challenges we face in the next 30 years of our world. Do you want to talk about some of the challenges that you foresee?
Four is probably an optimistic number. Just to give people a kind of a framework, we've kind of left globalization now.
Yeah.
We're in a regime that I call the interregnum, which is kind of a period in between two fixed states. We don't quite know where we're going. There's lots of opportunity to build new institutions, rules of the 21st century. To get there, we have to get through a number of hurdles. We have a lot of debt in the world, certainly in the older economies in China. So we need to overcome that hurdle. Democracy is in a crisis. We can chat about that. We have to get over the hurdle of managing climate damage across the world. And then there's a couple of other things that are probably more positive and more exciting. So one is the impact of new technologies, from small nuclear reactors to AI. Then also the challenge of building institutions and laws and rules and regulations around those.
So that's quite interesting. And just on that institution part, I think in your book, you mentioned that the social contract that people had with the government, with the institutions and the politicians and maybe each other is disintegrating. Why do you think it's disintegrating? And what was the social contract in the first place, just for our listeners to understand?
In different countries in the world, you have the social contract, which is this idea the people and the government or the state are bound together in a kind of a bargain. The most straightforward version is the idea of the Chinese dream, which is that in China, people will give up their liberty, their political liberty, in exchange for the government creating prosperity. And the Chinese have done a remarkable job of this consistently for the last 30, 40 years. But what we're beginning to see now is that wealth in parts of the Chinese economy is being eroded. The property market is weaker. There are big pockets of indebtedness. That's going to be the big test, and particularly if unemployment begins to rise in China, as to whether this contract will hold. In Europe, the contract is very, very different, particularly in continental Europe, France, for example. The state is a provider of services, education, healthcare, your pension, etc. But you live in a democracy and you're free to express yourself. And by God, people in France express themselves.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. That's an interesting one. And since we mentioned democracy, it sort of is worth talking about it. You put a figure in your book where after 2005, I think the number of democracies in the world is sort of decreasing. When you had a good period before that, the good 20 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, where it was sort of increasing, right? But when I say increase and decrease, I mean both in terms of quantity, but also quality as well.
It's
just like having elections. You might have rigged elections. You might have elections which are shams and stuff like that. To me, it seems the idea of democracy lately has been decoupled from progress and quality of life. Why do you think that happened?
Yeah, if you measured it like an econometrician, you'd still find a very tight correlation. It's actually the countries that they're the most happiest countries, best quality of life, they are the best democracies as well. So the relationship is still there. Mm. Democracy is under threat for a whole load of reasons. I'll touch on some of them. So one is the world is now geopolitically divided between effectively the democratic West and a couple of very big autocracies. And the autocracies are visibly and manifestly attacking democracy. So Russia with internet bots, etc. So that is damaging. The second one is that we're in a period of rising inflation where public finances are constrained. There's less money to go around. People probably feel more under pressure. Typically, through history, you get these democratic waves, ups and downs. And when you have financial crisis and different types of crisis, you tend to get political crisis as well. There is this idea that that democracy as a system is under attack. Politicians in the West have not done a good job of innovating and renewing democracy. The idea of a democratic panic is now upon us, and people are beginning to fight back, as it were.
Yeah, that makes sense, really. If you were to have solutions on how we can revive democracies, where would you start?
One area that is really key is education. Having a very good standard of education in any country makes for a better society and a better public life. Secondly, I would introduce the teaching of democracy in a basic sense into schools and make it quite practical so that young people know how to engage in public life. They know how to have a debate, because then one of the other areas, I think, is social media, and social media is polluting democracy. And the quality of debate in public life generally has deteriorated with social media. And social media amplifies the extreme views on the extreme left and the extreme right. And it's also leading to violence against public officials. I mean, friends of mine who are in public life, they can't read the feedback on their Twitter feed because it's just so ugly. And people behave on the internet in ways they wouldn't behave in public. And that's effectively cowardly. So that's a start. In specific countries, there are other things that governments can do. So in Ireland, we've had a lot of success with the Citizens Assembly. That's quite contextually specific because Ireland is a country where there's a lot of trust amongst people. People trust their fellow citizens to do sensible things, and it's quite an intimate country. So if I had to take that and transplant it to, say, France, I wouldn't start at the national level. I'd start at the regional or departmental level and keep it quite local. So I suppose what I'm saying is that there are lots of democratic innovations out there, but they have to be implemented in a context-specific way.
That's quite interesting. You launched your new book in French. It's translated as like the People's Agreement.
Yeah.
Is this something related to what you mentioned, the People's Agreement of the 21st century version?
Yeah. If you can kind of tolerate me dipping into history.
Yeah.
So sure, one of the things that troubles a lot of people is that there is all this kind of noise in social media and criticism of democracy. But at the same time, we have to find ways of channeling people's desires for a better form of politics and democracy. One example that goes back to history is in England in the middle of the 17th century, when the king was in prison and people had, for the first time in a European country, they had a chance to imagine what a democracy might look like. This is a unique moment in European history. And you had this event called the Putney Debates, where effectively ordinary people, men and women, debated what a democracy would look like and what they wanted from it. They wrote these down as they were called the Agreement of the People. And it's very practical. Anyone who read it today would say, oh, well, it makes a lot of sense to me. That's a template that I thought was quite useful in terms of trying to get people just to focus on writing down and expressing clearly four or five things they want from their democracy. And it can be very, very practical. So in the Putney Debates, they had requirements that everyone is treated the same in terms of the debt courts. So the rich people don't get off with not paying their debts while the poor go to prison. And you still have that in many countries today, or in having term limits for politicians, for example. And that's still a big thing today if you look at the US. Having these kind of templates is actually quite important. And the other thing we're trying to do is just find ways to give ordinary people a bigger voice or a bigger say so that they can participate more in democracy. Because that's a big problem as well, is that in many countries, the level of abstention, people who don't vote, is quite a big thing. Mm-hmm. So in some European countries, it can be 30%.
To me, as a layperson, and maybe there are assumptions embedded into it, what I see is that people are less interested in the exact political operating philosophy of a state and more interested in how that actually translates to their quality of life. I've spent some time in places like Singapore, which is extremely well-run governments. It's not a quote-unquote democracy, but great economic growth. People are great. It's squeaky clean. Quite similarly, I've been to other places like Rwanda as well, where, you know, I'm not sure they have elections, or they might have elections. So, but those are considered pseudo autocracies in a lot of way. But people seem like they're doing well. I was just listening to another podcast, I think it was called The Rest of Politics. It was talking about how corruption in the Singaporean government is dealt much, much better. And they have much higher standards of dealing with corruption in the government than the British parliament, where people can get away, especially the Tory government, can get away with lots and lots of stuff. To me, it's a thing like, okay, we are saying that, democratic values and freedom of expression and choice are important in voting and stuff like that. But to me, the bigger question mark remains is that how does this actually translate to better quality of life?
Yeah, that's interesting, because what you're saying is that people are behaving as consumers, not citizens.
And correct.
Yeah. That is increasingly how I think a lot of young people behave, or at least it's how surveys describe describe what young people are doing and feeling. And actually, amongst young people, there's a big divergence between what young women want and what young men want.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, it's incredible.
I actually think it's the wrong way to approach democracy because it's very individualistic, very atomized. It means you don't think about the collective good. It means you don't think about public goods, things like education and justice. And a young person listening to this might think, well, that's all fine. Those are just words. But then when something goes wrong, and when someone doesn't allow you to have to think, or when someone decides to frame how you are educated or determines what you can do, that's then when you begin to sort of think like a citizen, not a consumer. As societies evolve, people tend to demand more freedom and more space to think and to speak. Singapore is an interesting example because it's got a very, very coherent model, and that model is internalized in all the Singaporeans. They know exactly how the state is run. They have generally admirable, very high quality people running the state. Britain is going the other way. And what's interesting at the moment is that you have the kind of a bit like a football league, you have the rise and fall of nations. And Britain is certainly a country that is in decline economically, if you look at productivity, but also the quality of politics. Corruption is definitely on the rise there. And that's a big issue. It hasn't traditionally been a big issue, but certainly in the last 10 years, it's becoming a very, very big issue. And that's having an effect, to go back to this example of citizens versus consumers, that has a big effect on the quality of life of people in the UK. And if you take away London, the quality of life of people across the UK is in sharp decline.
Yeah, even London. I mean, I live in London and it feels like the quality of life, I talk to people, obviously the inflation pressures have not really helped. People feel like they have less of their disposable income left for other things. And yeah, generally it feels like quite a declining perception, but not only perception, but they feel it in their public expenditure and private lives, really. Which brings us to something that you love and specialize in is, I guess, finance and economic aspect of things, really. You mentioned about some of the ways that where our economies are going, or world economy is going, and some of the economic decisions taken by the Western central banks and countries like that. I think specifically you mentioned about like productivity decline, and obviously in Britain, for instance, the GDP per capita growth has been frozen for the last 20 years, actually. What's your opinion on economic growth, and how has economic growth been? There's rising inequality as well. Tell me more about what are some of the decision makings that we've done in the last like 20, 30 years on the economy, and where you think we went wrong.
Britain, I would say the quality of GDP growth has suffered maybe in the last 7 or 8 years. If you look at productivity, we're actually in a very strange period economically. So if you took an AI model, people on the podcast will be familiar with what I'm going to describe, and you trained it on economic data, maybe from 2009 back 150 years, and for the UK and US, there's good data. And you said, tell me what's going to happen next. The AI would probably forecast, well, we're going to have these economic cycles of, say, 5 years, there might be a couple of debt crises, etc. In effect, we haven't had that. We've had two incredibly long periods of expansion in the last maybe 20 or 30 years, two of the longest periods of expansion ever. And they've enabled a lot of wealth creation, but they've also, as they've grown, they've stored up a lot of negatives. So wealth inequality in the US is a big problem. Debt is a problem. So the way I tend to describe it, it's a bit like a kind of an aging athlete, that is, as the cycle goes on, you run out of organic growth, and companies and governments take on more debt to try and push output. So we're now at a level where in the UK, parts of Europe like France, the US, debt to GDP is close to 100% of GDP. And that historically is very, very high, and tends to kind of set off a flashing red light in terms of, might there be an impending debt crisis? You look at Japan, debt to GDP is maybe 300 or 400%. China, on paper, looks quite small, but potentially is actually quite big. Debt, we're in what I call the age of debt. It's a bit like we're beginning to evolve in terms of how we deal with that. And there's a whole kind of what I call a debt industry growing up around that. So you mentioned London, 30% of all the almost unicorn startups in London are in fintech, and many of them are in debt and lending. So this whole new industry of trying to give people more money, buy now, pay later, etc. And we're creating a new industrial structure around debt, which I think is ultimately dangerous, beginning to resemble what happened in the run-up to the global financial crisis. But we're managing through it at the moment. And I think once you don't get another big inflationary shock, we're probably okay for another couple of years. But in terms of the actual size of indebtedness, it's actually quite hard to reduce. There are few countries that have managed to do so. Ireland is one because it's got a very, very high level of GDP growth.
That's quite interesting. The US and UK, they're at like 100% debt to GDP, whereas Japan, you said, like is 3x that, right? But the Japanese economy is still running pretty well. And they've got a GDP per capita was quite high, very like successful society. They've got demographic problems, which is an issue. There's this other theories where like the new MMT, like modern monetary theory, basically that the state is not like a household as long as the US government is the greatest of all and it's got the military might to impose and people want to buy those government bonds around the world, they will always be issuing more and more of them and taking more and more debt. So what do you make of that? How does this scale up? It seems like Japan is doing it. So is there a 3x margin the US and UK can go?
Yes, MMT is rubbish. It's not a bona fide theory. Effectively, it's an argument for the US to try and mortgage what people call its exorbitant privilege, which is the unique role the dollar plays in the world economy. And it could do that for some time. What it does is it accumulates even more systematic risk over time. Bad economics, bad finance, and ultimately bad politics. Mm. Japan is doing something that's slightly different. It's almost like an illusion. It's asking its central bank to sort of hoover up government debt. The central bank in Japan owns, I don't have the exact figure off the top of my head, but maybe 55-60% of government GDP. So it's kind of not only the buyer of last resort, it's kind of the buyer of government debt. And that can continue for as long as people are prepared to believe that this is sustainable. At some point where they don't, you probably get a really violent move in the currency that can create an almost existential crisis in Japanese assets. Or if there's a massive repricing of the Japanese bond market, it's a bit like a plane. The sort of three phases in a plane journey: takeoff, cruising, and landing. Many of the big economies are in cruising mode. Growth is positive. There are big problems. No one's really tried to land the plane to try and address these issues. But when they do, it can become quite bumpy and dangerous.
Yeah. And why do you think we became so obsessed with debt, basically, as a society and as an economy? Is that the decoupling from like the dollar to the gold standard that started means that you can print whatever and issue whatever bonds and stuff like that? What do you think were the triggers and first trigger? And then what do you think of the accelerators?
Yeah, it's probably much later than that, because if you go back to the Asian crisis in the late 90s, after then, it would have been the orthodoxy that taking a lot of debt.
What was the Asian crisis again?
The Asian crisis was in the late 1990s, centered around countries like Taiwan, who were fast growing. But again, like some countries today, accumulated debt and vulnerabilities as they, and Hong Kong as well. And then in the early 2000s, the policy sense in the world would have been that taking on too much debt was a bad thing and a dangerous thing. And corporate debt to asset ratios or government debt to GDP were much, much smaller. What happened maybe after the global financial crisis was that people bought into the idea that debt was bad, but central banks with QE, quantitative easing, where they would buy bonds, can soften the impact of it, and that we actually need to take on more debt to escape this recession. And that's fine. If that's just going to last 1 year, then we go back to normal policymaking. But this emergency policy setting has become the norm. And there are very few politicians today who will address the issue of indebtedness. People like the IMF talk around it and they warn about it, but that's a defunct institution. They don't really matter anymore. There's this connivance across the policy community. Mm-hmm. And also we've had a couple of big emergencies. So we've had obviously COVID. We now have a couple of geopolitical emergencies, and that's giving governments both the need and the excuse to borrow more.
Just pulling on that thread, why do you think IMF is a defunct institution?
One, it's probably done what it was initially set up to do, which is to coordinate finance across nations. Some of those nations have kind of grown bigger than the IMF, China as an example. Secondly, it's had a whole string of leaders who individually, from Dominic Strauss-Kahn to a bunch of others, individually have little credibility. And then also, I think in a number of crises, it hasn't performed. Greece is just one example. And Argentina is another one where the introduction of the IMF has both made things worse. They've come off second best in these cases. If you look at financial markets, people in financial markets and the big banks, debt markets pay very little heed to what the IMF is doing. One other thing is that as the world becomes more regional, an international body like the IMF matters incrementally less, actually.
That's quite interesting. I have actually an excerpt here from your book where you said that, and I quote, "A world in we need to go to a world in which new framework for organic growth will need to be discovered. A world where many artificial stimulants to growth, such as indebtedness and central bank asset purchases, will need to be pared back." In your sort of thinking, how do states achieve this good organic economic growth, would you say, versus relying on these artificial stimulants going into 2024 and whatever's left of this decade, really?
It depends on the state of evolution of those states. You mentioned Rwanda, for example. That country, it can continue to grow at a high level of GDP just by building physical infrastructure. And it can do so for maybe the next couple of decades. And also it depends a lot on what its neighbors are doing. For countries then at the other end, if you look at, say, Switzerland as being the example par excellence, they have companies that make highly specialized tools and also services in industry and services. They invest massively in education. They have probably the best universities in continental Europe, a big focus on research and development and the whole internalizing this whole idea of excellence. For me, that's the magic sauce. Focus on research and development, education at all the different layers from apprenticeships up to PhDs in quantum physics. Very clear set of rules, regulations, laws that balance helping innovation, but also protecting people as well.
That's quite interesting, really. But just to be the devil's advocate, Britain is great at R&D. You know, we have got some of the best universities in the world when it comes to R&D. You saw that during the pandemic and the vaccine research and stuff. Some of the research here coming for AI and a lot of the other AI companies outside the US, it's basically the UK. In other fields as well, you see it's quite doing quite well. I would like to say a British education system is actually quite good compared to some of the other countries in the world, but it's not really translating into organic growth per se. I'm just wondering what is wrong there. What is it kind of missing?
So I think if you went to Manchester or Leeds or Nottingham, and you just, if you said that to someone, they wouldn't recognize the country you've just spoken about. So on a net basis, the quality of education in the UK in terms of attainment levels, spending has deteriorated. There's actually a very, very good report by a guy called David Willetts, who was the Tories' chief in-house thinker for a long time. He was a minister for science and innovation. I'm going to digress a bit but it's interesting. It helps to answer the question. Yeah. He came up with, I think it was in 2012, 2013, 8 technologies of the future. He was absolutely bang on. They were the, like he mentioned, AI, quantum, etc. And he said, well, we have to invest in education in these areas. He then left government, but he's recently written a kind of a review of what happened. He said, okay, well, we got the technologies right. What we didn't do is invest enough in education. We actually educated people from abroad who then went back to China. I mean, there's 120,000 Chinese being educated in the UK, and most of them don't stay. So they don't contribute to the economy and to society. Then there was a whole raft of political changes in the departments that ran things like innovation. It was effectively devalued as a sort of policy area. And if you look at the UK with telecoms, for example, the UK was the center of the telecoms industry in the 80s and 90s because they got out early and they set the standards and they built expertise. You had big companies like Vodafone, and they haven't done that in AI. And actually, in fact, Paris and Berlin are probably the AI hubs in Europe. You have American companies located in the UK, but in terms of indigenous UK-built AI firms, there's not that many to speak of.
Yeah, it's an interesting prospect, really. And the case for Brexit was that, like, we're going to be independent, blah, blah, and maybe Paris will take over London and yada, yada. But I was just seeing the data the other day that the number of unicorn startups, so companies which are valued at a billion-dollar valuation, just in the UK is more than whole of Europe combined. So yeah, it's quite an interesting sort of aspect. But yeah, I take your point around around investing in education and so on and so forth. We talked about economy and we talked about growth. We talked about the GDP to debt. I think you mentioned in your book that the question of whether GDP is even the right measure here. And I think you mentioned about some of the smaller countries doing something called the well-being economy. Can you explain a little bit more of what is this well-being economy and what sort of experiment are they doing and why they're doing that?
Yeah, the whole debate around GDP and whether it's the right measure is a false debate because I think in the economics community and also people in financial markets, everyone is aware that there are multiple ways to look at economic performance and everyone has the bank of data in front of them. I think what happens is that once you enter into a public debate and you're in newspapers, you have to reduce the argument to one or two kind of core numbers. But I don't think we need any more, any new economic benchmarks. What is happening, I think, with what this idea of well-being is, it's really, first of all, the quality of growth. Is it sustainable? What are the factors generating it? And then what kind of society is it beginning to produce? If you look at the Nordic economies generally, some of the smaller states you mentioned, Singapore, which is a good example, they grow, but they also have stable societies and stable rules and etc. There's a sense of well-being in terms of both what people's expectations are, but also what the outcomes on those people in terms of their lives as citizens and healthcare and being able to create a family.
That makes sense, really. In terms of your book, you also mentioned something about geography versus values and how that's sort of changing. You mentioned that currently values shape destiny of a state rather than just geography. What did you try to get at when you mentioned that?
As we've gone through history, geography has been a significant determinant of what happens to a country. Ireland is a good example because it's far away on the west of Europe. It was colonized geopolitically, has been quiet for some time, but in recent years, it's had a similar cultural and value set to the US, which has actually, in my view, has been a much bigger factor in US investment into Ireland than, say, tax rates, for example. That's an interesting example. And what's also beginning to happen around Europe is that we're seeing now which countries in Europe are, in terms of their value set, are really European. So Serbia and Hungary looks like across the board, they are manifestly preferring to adhere to, let's say, we call it a Russian value set. In the future, they'll probably pay for that politically and economically.
That's quite interesting. I mean, it almost seems to me we had a bit of an empty period of nothingness where Pax Americana existed, right, after the fall of the Soviet Union. And now it seems that other ideology of governance is sort of coming in, and it's almost like the red states and the rest of the world, the free world versus whoever's allied, the Russia and the Chinas and stuff like that. To me, it seems quite interesting. But other thing also interesting is you mentioned about geography being less of a factor. The internet is actually a great example of that as well. Just within the same geography, you have completely different worlds because they're spending more and more time on the internet through smartphones, through gadgets, very soon through immersive AR, VR tech that's being launched, right? And they're aligning themselves in social communities. For instance, if you are very much to the right in the US, you just download Truth Social, like that's Donald Trump's platform, and that's your world. The algorithm keeps feeding you into that world versus if you are, quote unquote, still a Democrat and you listen to maybe the more other Democratic outlets that's there. It seems to me that irrespective of geography, people are aligning themselves online a little bit more. That's where they are getting their values. This is only the beginning where the metaverse, what we call it, where your virtual life becomes more and more important than your actual life.
Yeah. This is probably underestimated and it's completely historic because human beings have gone through lots of evolutions. We've gone through the Industrial Revolution. We've gone through maybe the 20th century, people working less with their hands and more with their brain. But there's never, in my view, been a period in history where we have started to lose our sociability and where we have had much, much less human contact. So if you get on the tube in London or the metro in Paris, everyone is on their phones and no one's looking at each other. No one is talking to each other. It's not perplexing because we know what's happening. It's hugely damaging. What is beginning to come out of it is there are lots of impacts on how we socialize and how young people are not able to socialize properly anymore. They don't have relationships with each other. If you look at, say, fertility rates in Asia, there are some, you know, alarming statistics in countries like China, Japan, the X percent of people from 35 to 20 have never had a relationship with the opposite sex. This is a completely new departure in thousands of years of humanity, highly linked to social media. The amplitude of it is not yet being realized.
Yeah. One aspect of your book where I was vigorously nodding my head was when you mentioned about how technology sort of affects everything. You specifically mentioned where the world is not silent anymore, that we don't have the luxury of isolating themselves from one field of finance, say politics, like technology complicates literally the whole shebang that's there. Have you thought about it in any more detail on how can we navigate this more complex future better? Like one thing I've thought about, and before I come to you, is that, and the reason I started the podcast was that I was seeing technology affect like literally everything, like you said, like politics to science and economics and social media and to people. I call it the human stack, where you've got the individual, then you've got the family, then you've got the civil society, and then you've got the religious institutions like mosques and parishes. Then you have local government, federal government, and then you have international organizations, and technology is affecting through the whole stack. My thinking was that we need more polymathic thinking, where people who know about economics, but also politics, and make a full picture of how things are. What's your thinking in terms of how can we navigate this very complex terrain with technology so pervasive?
That's a very good point. Actually, I mean, to go back, you mentioned Singapore. So the Prime Minister of Singapore is a mathematician and an economist. Having those polymath thinkers in politics is probably a good thing. Whether they want to go into politics or not is probably a different question. Yeah. A lot of the technology makes it so that you don't actually want to get involved.
Yeah, it's like Plato's philosopher kings, right? Who are not interested in being kings.
Exactly. It's very difficult if you think about policymakers, right? So their time is consumed or has been consumed by economic crisis, COVID, Ukraine, etc. But behind them, there's this big picture evolving where tech is on top of everything. As a government, you can do different things in the States and in maybe Europe and in China as well. Because tech is so strategic, governments are actually co-opting the tech companies to be part of their arsenal, if you like. That makes it harder to regulate them and regulate the impact they have on consumers. We've also just had the very interesting example of the European AI Act, which does quite a good job just framing how AI will affect people in different ways and trying to limit the impact of that. So in Europe, you can't use AI to the same extent that they have in China in terms of social control. But some AI companies in Europe and France in particular have managed to push the regulations so that they have a freer hand to experiment. The next 10 years will be probably all about trying to build rules of the road on AI. And the UK is interesting because the current government, the Tory government, have said that they will not regulate AI. Labour will probably have to do so. One of the areas that's coming on the horizon is how AI affects work. Does it mean that accountants and lawyers are going to be paid half as much in the future? Or does it mean that doctors, really good doctors, can be paid twice as much? We're on the cusp of a lot of these questions that I think are going to be discovered in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and very interesting times indeed. One last thread I do want to pull is, in your book you mentioned about the multipolar world that we're entering into, and particularly what that means for the rest of the world markets that are there, and rest of the world economies that are there. The gist of what I understood from your writings is that if you're like a smaller country, say Bhutan or Bangladesh or whatever, previously, last 30 years, it was quite simple. You just align yourself towards the Euro-American infrastructures, right, and values. That's where you want to be, versus now where it's a bit more multipolar. What do you think about the rest of the world markets? How should they think about nation and economic building?
Yeah. This is another whole podcast.
Fair. Gotta come back.
I think, unfortunately, people label the rest of the world as the global south, and I don't think that's fair on them because they are quite different. Okay. They don't yet have a coherent body together. In many of these countries,
they're trying with BRICS and stuff, right? Basically,
I mean, BRICS is an acronym that was developed by Goldman Sachs, and the BRICS countries themselves are very different. And they don't really collaborate. They had some of them are run by kind of strong men or autocrats who club together, they are a million miles away from the European Union, where you've got common institutions, etc. Lately, actually, the BRICS economies are probably, maybe India is the exception, but they're struggling a bit. I'm also thinking of kind of populous countries, Bangladesh, Indonesia, etc. Indonesia is a very, very good example of a country that's had a great period of development. It's actually not talked enough about in international economics. And all these countries are probably getting to a stage where they've had a good period of growth, and now they need to build institutions, they have emerging middle classes. My strong bias is to go for the model, the European-centric model of having strong institutions and tilting towards citizens, not consumers, etc. Politicians, it's more difficult because it takes more time. Also, people's expectations are very high and they want kind of quick growth, and that's not as easy anymore. As a final point, I would just look at where do people want to live, right? Someone from Bhutan had to go abroad. Where would they like to live? Would they like to live in America or Europe or China? Probably not China. I mean, there's, I said, 120,000 Chinese living in the UK. There's maybe 2,000 students from the UK and the US living in China. So if they're given a choice, they still want to go to the West. And that tells you something.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And just before yourself, I had Dr. Joseph Nye on the podcast, who's the inventor of the idea of soft power.
I think
the West does have a lot more sort of kind of the soft power, and the liberalization of personal freedoms and stuff like that does contribute towards values and cultures, right, which are attractive to any sort of person versus some of those countries. Really nice chatting to you. With that, we'll leave it at that. And like you mentioned,
thanks very much. I've enjoyed it.
Tons of topics to pull the thread on, but we might need to have another conversation again. But thank you so much, Mike Sullivan, for joining us, and we hope to have you back again.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to the Innovation Civilization podcast. If you love the podcast, please subscribe on all major platforms, as well as please share it with your friends and family. Thank you very much for listening, and see you soon for the next episode.